from the Gettysburgian and 91.1 WZBT Gettysburg. I'm Jamie Welch, and this is On Target.
I'm Ben Potts. Today on Target, we'll talk about mold, and then we'll hear from Gettysburgian Opinions editor Josh Wagner.
Then, we'll talk with U.S. Congressman Scott Perry about a wide range of issues. Stay with us.
All right, well, we don't have a whole lot of time to get into the news, which is probably a good thing, because not a whole lot has happened except for, you know, the monumental decision to, probably an unprecedented decision, to give every resident of Hanson Hall $250. Why are we doing this, Jamie?
Well, that's because the residents of Hanson Hall, and I guess some are former residents of Hanson Hall that had to be relocated, were displaced because of a mold infestation, which was discovered over winter break. At first, they thought it was just going to be the basement residents that would need to be remediated, and they had previously suggested offering...
Just to be clear, the residents didn't need to be remediated.
They needed to be relocated so that the basement could be remediated.
Just to be clear, there was no need for, say, academic remediation.
Indeed.
Oh, this went off the rails pretty quickly.
That did go.
But in any case, this is going to cost the college approximately $40,000 in this era of sustainable excellence. Budget constraints all over. Do find it a little bit curious that this $40,000 just exists. We asked Jamie Yates about that, the college's executive director of communications and media relations. She said that a funding source has been identified for all for both the $40,000 in compensation as well as the mold remediation project, and that it would not affect other program offerings or staffing or anything in the Office of Residential and First Year Programming. I can also report that next Monday at the meeting of the Gettysburg College Student Senate, Kira Kant, Associate Dean of College Life and who oversees residential and first year programming, will be present.
Programs, residential and first year programs.
Programs, programming, it's roughly the same thing.
It's not really.
It is in fact the same thing. They are just two different words. In any case, Kira Kant will be at the Senate meeting to, I guess, answer questions and hear from students who are, I think, still concerned about this. There's an article up on the Gettysburgian's website that, you know, really, if you've missed some of this story, you can catch up by checking in there and also hear from some students, who, some of whom claim that they've had property damage in excess of $250, one number that was floated at the Senate meeting by Senator Abby Hauer, who's a first year, was $1,000. You know, I think it's probably difficult to, you know, appraise the value of everything, but the college says 250 is the max. They're not reimbursing beyond that.
Yeah.
And that personal insurance could cover other things if people have it.
Exactly. Yeah. Students can absolutely get renter's insurance. It's one of the things that I know was recommended to get renter's insurance, because typically landlords and the such are not responsible for personal property damage unless they were grossly negligent, which it's going to be also very tough to prove some of this property damage because they've thrown the items away. So there's no actual evidence that items were damaged. So I think, honestly, that the $250 was pretty fair. I think it's a move that I haven't seen before in my 4 years here. Typically, refunds are not a thing that happens.
Well, yeah, and quite frankly, I mean, I've spoken to multiple Hanson residents from years past who have had items damaged by the mold. And, they didn't know it was a systemic issue, as it apparently is, but they didn't get any money. So, I mean, it'll be interesting to see where this goes from here, if this sets any kind of precedent, which I think the college is probably desperately seeking to avoid. Other than that, that's really the only story we wanted to mention today. We'll head into some great intermediating content. You're going to hear from Josh Wagner, who wrote, if I do say so, a pretty hilarious and on target in many ways opinion piece regarding the real world. And then we'll get into the bullet report. And finally, Scott Perry. We'll be right back.
And now joining us here on Target, we have Joshua Wagner, who is the opinions editor over at the Gettysburgian, who published an editorial this week in the print edition entitled Welcome to Planet Earth. And here's Joshua with a dramatic reading of the piece.
Welcome to Planet Earth. I will be your guide. A religious cult has emerged on campus. Its followers believe in a utopia and wait spellbound for the day they will embark to that land. Rare as a unicorn and more elusive than Donald Trump's hairline, this utopia is spoken of forebodingly and with awe. If you listen on a cold, crisp winter's night, you can actually hear the great conjurers gasping with glee. Just wait until you get to the real world. There's only one problem with this cult. Earth is the real world. It's time everyone realized that. The oceans, servo cookies, that weird smell after it rains, entropy, enthalpy, feline AIDS, the Library of Congress, backpacks, dinosaur fossils, CNN, they're all real. If this comes as a shock to you, just wait, there's more. The people around you are real too. They each have interesting life stories and unique perspectives. Try talking to one, and you may find this to be true. After you have acquainted yourself with the fact that you inhabit the same planet as everybody else, stop letting people tell you that you are about to enter the real world. This is propaganda, and it needs to stop. For example, some people are getting flustered about the new philosophy on freedom of expression. Apparently, we should brace ourselves for the moment we plunge into the cold, cruel, and very real world. Instead, we're being coddled into believing that people deserve respect and that society has rules of decorum. They are referring to a completely unfiltered, post-graduation dystopia. In this wild west of personal discourse, anything goes. Disappointment awaits the members of this real-world cult because many companies have similar anti-discriminatory policies as the college. Actually, 89% of Fortune 500 companies prohibit discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, and 66% of Fortune 500 companies prohibit discrimination based on gender identity. If this trend continues, these numbers will only go up. I'm really confused why the real-world cult chose freedom of speech as the focal point of preparation for their brave new world. There are so many arbitrary rules. Don't jump in the fountain. Wear clothes. Avoid injuring your roommate. Don't cheat. Get vaccinated. Have health insurance. Don't lay down in the middle of the street, etc., etc., etc. Of all the rules to question, why anti-discrimination? It'd be much more entertaining if people thought they had the God-given right to jump in the fountain or walk around campus in the nude, or, a personal favorite, both simultaneously. In the real world, people jump in the fountain, so why can't we here? To conclude, Gettysburg College is on planet Earth. The one, the only, the realest world we have. If you encounter anyone who believes otherwise, tell them to write an opinions piece for the Gettysburgian. We'd love to hear about it.
And if we have any of our listeners who want to write an opinions piece for the Gettysburgian, where should they send them to, Josh?
Well, I would send it to my email, which is wagnjo08 at gettysburg.edu.
Don't forget that 08. Most people are 01, but he is the eighth person with that name combination to go here. So
that just shows that I'm eight times as special as everybody else.
Now I believe we have Ben Ponce with our bullet report.
It's been an exciting couple of weeks in Gettysburg College Athletics, going all the way back to the men's track and field Albright Invitational on February the 10th, where the men finished 2nd out of 10, when the women finished 1st out of 9. The men's basketball team lost to Muhlenberg 59-72 on the 10th. The men's swimming team defeated Franklin and Marshall 165-93. The wrestling team finished 4th out of 8 at the Centennial Conference Championships. The women's basketball team defeated Bryn Mawr 78-31, also on the 10th. On the 14th, Valentine's Day, the women's basketball team defeated McDaniel 55-34, and the men's basketball team defeated McDaniel 56-41. The men's track and field team did not receive a team score at the Susquehanna Invitational, nor did the women's team, but both were largely successful. At the Swarthmore Invitational, both the men and the women participated, but again, there were no team scores. The men's lacrosse team won against Messiah on the 17th, 12-9. The men's basketball team lost 77-60 in Coach George Petrie's final game on the Bullets sidelines. The women's basketball team defeated Ursinus 76-60, and the men's wrestling team lost to York 25-17. Women's basketball is headed for the playoffs. We'll have that for you next week on the Bullet Report, which has thus endeth.
Thanks so much for that, Ben. We'll be right back with U.S. House Representatives member Scott Perry.
And we're thrilled to be joined today by United States Congressman for the 4th District in Pennsylvania, Republican Scott Perry.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for the invitation.
Yeah, our pleasure. So for those who may not be familiar with you, your personal background, can you just kind of give a brief introduction where you came from, how you got into politics? I know you're in the Pennsylvania National Guard.
And yeah. Well, let me see. I live in Dillsburg. I got a wife and two small children, 6 and an 8-year-old. And I grew up in Dillsburg, went to Northern High School, Penn State grad, joined the military when I was 18 years old as an E-1 or a private. It's the lowest rank that you can be in the Army. And at the pinnacle of my career, now currently a Brigadier General, went to flight school to fly rotary wing. That's helicopter. Was privileged to fly just about every aircraft in the Army's inventory: Cobras, Black Hawks, Chinook, Apache, Huey. You name it. I flew it. Instructor pilot, etc. Started a business as well, a mechanical contracting business. And all along the way, I knew at some point, well, it was actually first grade, I knew that I was a Republican in first grade. I told my parents who I thought they ought to vote for.
Did they listen?
I'm not sure. I didn't check their vote, right? So, we have a secret ballot, so to speak. So I just urged them who I thought they should vote for. And I never really was, I never did anything about it. We grew up pretty poor. The house that I grew up in Dillsburg didn't have any electricity or running water. We chopped wood most of the summer to heat it in the wintertime. We went to a thing called an outhouse, which is a hole in the ground. And for much of my life, I was a guy with a lot of dirt underneath my fingernails. I went to Votech for auto mechanics, and I was just working my way through. But it ended up, I was putting myself through college. I took a political science class to finish up some credits that I needed to get, and it turned out I really enjoyed it, and I was kind of captivated by it. So I asked how to get involved. And that's kind of how it got started for me. I never intended to run for office. And quite honestly, I thought it was for people that were connected, people of privilege. And that wasn't at all me. Mm-hmm. I was working full time to go to school full time. But I got involved, and one thing led to another, running campaigns and volunteering. And I decided one time, well, maybe I can run too. And that's mm-hmm. just how it worked out.
And then, so you served a few terms in the state house.
In the state house,
and then
right.
ran for the U.S. House.
I had my hands full in the state house with state issues. And one, I think it was a late morning, the York County delegation, the members of the representatives, got a call from then Congressman Platts, who said, in about 15 minutes, I'm going to announce my retirement. And at that time, we were doing what's called circulating petitions, nominating petitions to run. And I was going to run for the state house again. And I was texting my campaign manager, who was on the way to the post office with my petitions. And I texted him. I said, wait, period, stop, period, turn around, period, I'll explain later. And we literally had about 2 days to make a decision. So I talked to my wife. We talked to our pastor, said a few prayers, and said, well, maybe we should take a shot at federal elective office. Maybe we got something to offer. So I did. And lo and behold, again, it wasn't planned, but here I am.
Uh-huh. So, and then I guess we can go ahead and get into some of the issues.
Sure.
And there are several that we want to get to. But the first one that I know is on the many on the minds of many in the Gettysburg community and in Adams County is immigration.
Right, right.
And last week, there was a series of votes on various proposals to protect beneficiaries of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, program in the Senate in exchange for varying degrees of border security and other measures. Each of those votes failed. And so the deadline for this program is March 5th.
Right.
And so can you just kind of talk maybe in a broad sense your views on immigration, yeah, and then specifically whether you support extending the DACA program?
Right. Well, I'm frustrated by our immigration system. As probably many people, whether you've been involved in it or not, or read about it, or just kind of obliquely aware of it, it's severely broken. We actually, because it's so restrictive, we encourage lawlessness, and we kind of discourage abiding by the rules and requirements that we have. And unfortunately, from my time in Washington, what I've seen is that often, instead of working out the correct policy, the lawmakers work out a deal of what can get enough votes. And what you described last week was one of those occasions. And so what can get enough votes isn't necessarily the best policy. And I think what we're seeing now is, over decades now, a policy that doesn't really support the country at large, or immigrants that want to come here and do it legally. And I literally have constituents that will come in, they'll come into the office, and they will have been waiting 10 or 20 years, literally, here legally, working, but waiting 10 or 20 years and having to wait another 20 years because of the program they're in to gain their citizenship. And that's a program that is woefully broken. And of course, there are business needs. But at the same time, immigration, I think, generally speaking for me, I always listen to the stories from my mother, who's my grandmother came here from Colombia. It's a long family story about an early death in the family and a young lady who didn't want to live in somewhat of a caste system in Colombia, and decided to leave and come to America with nothing but the clothes on her back and the skill that she had, which is to work as a seamstress. She had that skill, and that's what she did. But at the time, the immigration was based on what you could provide to this country as well as yourself. Could you provide for yourself? And I think that to a certain extent, we need to look at and we need to consider what is best for our immigration policy. What should it be based on? Right now, it seems to be based on family immigration, but is that best for our country, and is that best for other neighboring countries, and what can we withstand? In other words, if it's going to be that kind of immigration, there's a certain cost to that, whether it's education, whether it's health care, whether, unfortunately, in some cases, it's incarcerated. These are all parts of the equation of paying for this thing, and then how do these folks assimilate into being Americans and being in America? And that's not really discussed, unfortunately. Now, so that having been said, of course, DACA is there. I will tell you that I think that when President Obama did that, it kind of chilled the conversation, because we were involved in the conversation. But once he did that and unilaterally took it off the table in the last session, we never revisited immigration. So now the president has decreed it the 5th. But at the same time, so that's a deadline. It's an artificial deadline, which, quite honestly, I think the president can, and I think it's likely that he will extend. But at the same time, the courts have said, well, that's not the deadline. You're going to continue with the DACA program. I would hope that while that's all occurring, that we would try and come to some solution. And I understand that the Senate failed in the span of a week, but I would say this too. For such a policy that is far-reaching as it is, I think we all know it's going to take the Senate more than a week to come up with something, right? But at the same time, I think the House should act. And there's a bill in the House that I support. It's generally described as the Goodlatte bill. Four members, Chairman Goodlatte, Chairman McCall from Homeland Security, Goodlatte's Judiciary, and then two subcommittee chairmen, Martha McSally from Arizona on the Border Subcommittee, and Raul Labrador from Idaho on the Immigration Subcommittee. They put this bill together, which deals with DACA, allows for legal status, and then deals with the enforcement side and the protective side of our border and interior enforcement and the other policy things that need to be addressed. And I hope the House takes that up and moves to pass that, so we can show the Senate, hey, we can pass something, we can find a solution, and then we can urge them to get on board with that and take some leadership.
Mm-hmm. So you sit on the Homeland Security Committee. And right. So, you know, one particular component of a lot of these you know, bills that have been tossed around is this idea of a physical wall
right.
on the southern border. In your, you know, based on your experience on that Homeland Security Committee and otherwise, do you think a wall would reduce illegal immigration, and should it be part of a plan, you know, to address all this immigration in a more comprehensive fashion?
I think some kind of a physical barrier, whether it's a wall in some places, and I think a wall in some places is appropriate, but some places it's not. Technology, there's a lot of different things we can do, but I would say that a wall in the middle of a river, right, and there's a river running through a good portion of the southern border is not appropriate. But I think that in some places it is. But I think it's kind of metaphorical in a way. I think that the American people see the wall as something that politicians that come and go, that say one thing and do another, is something that can't be changed easily. And you know, for me, who's a little bit older, I remember when we kind of went through the same discussion back in the 80s with President Reagan. And the promise was we're going to deal with everybody that came here illegally, and we're just going to grant them citizenship in return for border security. Well, what happened was that the citizenship was granted, and that's great, but the other side of the equation never happened, and people watched a lot of drugs come across the border, and certainly people that live across the border, they struggle with the influx of people on their land and so on and so forth. And so that part of the problem was never solved, and the American people say, well, hold on a second here. If we're fine with these people, and we understand many of them, especially the DACA recipients, you know, they're here just like my parents picked me up and moved me when I was a young person, right? So you don't have any choice in the matter. But if you're going to do that, okay, then let's secure this southern border, whether it's terrorism, whether it's drugs, whether it's illegitimate cargo coming across the border. Something must be done about that. And I think that's where this president is trying to put those two things together.
And so you mentioned that a wall a physical barrier is a part of the border security types of things that you would support. What other elements?
Well, for instance, as a guy who has served what we call downrange in the combat zone, we had to secure our perimeter on our base. And we would use a thing called an aerostat, which is simply a balloon that goes up on a tether with a camera on it. And you can survey the whole perimeter. So if you could put a series of those up, you wouldn't need as much personnel, and you may be in certain places where you certainly don't need a physical barrier, but you can maintain continuous observation of the border. So if there are incursions, whether it's drug, whether it's contraband or of some other type or whatever, you can interdict that, and it allows you to be more efficient, and you don't have to change the physical environment, so to speak. And so that's the technology piece. There's a whole host of different things that fall into that category, and I think that those need to be a part mm-hmm. of it.
And so just to be clear, circling around to kind of put a cap on this immigration discussion, we do have, I believe, 10 or 15 students at Gettysburg
sure.
College
right.
who are recipients of the DACA of DACA protection. And so to be clear, in exchange for some of those border security elements that you've kind of outlined and that are part of that GoodLatte bill, you would support extending a permanent protected status to those.
Yeah, I think it's important, and you hate to put it in the terms of exchange, right? That's not, because these are people's lives, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they, I don't know, but I can almost imagine maybe one day they woke up and they went to do something, and somebody said, well, you can't do that. Where's your citizenship? And they went home and they said, Mom, where's my dad? Where's my citizenship? And they found out then that they didn't have it. So that's important to consider that. Unfortunately, the way Washington works is you put a piece of legislation together and get the votes to pass it. And that's where you say, you know, you will accept this with that. But I think to solve this problem and to appease the American people who say, look, we want to take care of we're sensitive to these people that came and these DACA recipients, but at the same time, we don't want to encourage more of the same. We got to fix this problem, and we'll find a solution so we don't continue to have the same problem. Mm-hmm. And so they will be accepting of that if both those two things are together.
But to your point about, you know, not wanting it to be an exchange, if a just DACA were to come to the floor, would you vote to extend that without any of these other measures?
I think that to do that in clear honesty is to say that you're okay with the problem continuing, right? So you're just going to say, okay, there's no problem here. We're going to just extend this, or we're going to grant citizenship or what have you, and then we're not going to do anything to make a difference tomorrow, when the next person comes, and the next day when the next person comes. And I think to a certain extent, I have constituents that demand that I do something about that. So it would be hard for me to justify that.
Mm-hmm. So sticking with another sort of homeland security theme for a moment, last week, America experienced another mass shooting. This one killed 17 individuals at a school in Florida, making it, I believe, the ninth deadliest mass shooting in the United States history. The perpetrator allegedly used an AR-15 assault weapon. Not surprisingly, this tragedy has kind of reignited that debate over gun safety and gun control. I know you're a supporter of the NRA, and your website says, quote, "To be clear, the terms assault weapons and weapons of war are political phrases designed to evoke an emotional response. They're not a defined class of firearms. Remember, criminals who fail to obey laws in the first place certainly don't slash won't heed new laws. Attempting to stop acts of violence by banning firearms doesn't address the root cause of the violence," end quote. So in your view, what would address the root cause of that violence?
And I think it's a great question. I think we really have to have an in-depth conversation about what has changed. You go back, even in America's history, you go back 150 years where we had more guns per capita than we do now, but we didn't have these mass shootings. And I think you got to say to yourself, over the past 20 years, what has changed? Why was America an armed country per the Constitution, but suddenly in the last 10, 20 years, this has become somewhat epidemic? And it has become epidemic. And let's just be clear as well. I don't think whether you're conservative, whether you're liberal, Republican, Democrat, independent, anything, anywhere on the political spectrum, there's not one person I know that wants to see that happen. And I mean that. And it's tragic, and your heart goes out for the families that were impacted. And quite honestly, the country is heartbroken and hurting. That having been said, so you say to yourself, okay, well, let's have a reasoned discussion about, let's just talk about banning the AR-15. Well, if you just look at the Virginia Tech shooting, that's 2007, so that's about 10 years ago, the man used a pistol and killed about almost twice as many people. So, and then if you look at some societal things, I'm not sure. Look, I think if banning that weapon would make the difference and we'd never see another mass shooting, I think that would be a sticking point where most people would say, look, this is worth the infringement of your rights. But if banning it doesn't stop the mass shootings, then what have we accomplished? I think we really have to look at the root cause and decide, and you don't want to diminish it at all. But if you use it metaphorically, if you describe other things, for instance, you don't ban the car for drunk drivers, right? The car didn't do it. It was the driver of the car that did it. And that's not to oversimplify or to diminish at all what has occurred across our country on numerous occasions and most recently last week. But that informs us that there's a wider debate here. And if we really want to get to the solution, if we want to solve the problem, I think we have to open up our minds and be able to take in all information and think about it rationally. And it's a horrifically emotional event. And it touches all emotionally, but we have to include the rational portion of it as well.
Well, right. And so you mentioned the AR-15, and this was obviously not the first mass shooting in which that was the weapon that was used. So even if it wouldn't stop every mass shooting to ban the AR-15, you're saying that it would be, it's still not worth it.
Well, I think that's the point. I think we have to have an open, reasoned discussion and go through cause and effect and determine what will really make a difference. I mean, I think in the Texas church shooting, an AR-15 stopped the killer, if I remember correctly. So there's two sides of this equation. My point is that what we ought to be talking about is a solution that will actually work. And for instance, I think that for too long, we have hardened other targets, whether we like to think of it that way or not. It's the truth of the matter. You look at our federal courthouses or our state and local courthouses. You have to go through a metal detector. There are police present at the front door. Why is that? Right? Because people were going in there and shooting up the place. You look at what happened for aviation security, especially since 9/11. We've hardened those targets, but yet we've left our schools open. Why is that? And I think that there are some real easy, I think, force multipliers, if you will, or solution sets that help assist us to deter this kind of activity. What if we co-locate a satellite police office in our school. If you've got a town where there's a police force, why can't the police work out of the school on occasion, or maybe on a regular basis, maybe not the whole force, but even so, maybe it's time to think about co-locating police offices in our schools. Our schools have precious, what's most precious to us, our children. Mm-hmm. So, I think we have to be able to have this conversation and be able to discuss things without being belittled and shamed into saying, well, if you're not for my solution set, you're in favor of innocent people that are unarmed being killed. Nobody's in favor of that, but we have to be able to have the discussion.
You mentioned a moment ago about the AR-15 specifically, and that no one would argue that by banning the AR-15, we would end all mass shootings, but that, you know, because of that, it wouldn't be worth the infringement on people's rights to ban that AR-15. What would you say is a sort of legitimate use for a weapon of that nature that is not, you know, I hate to be blunt, but that is not killing people?
Well, I don't know if you can have any legitimate use other than self-defense and the Constitution for having a firearm. But I will tell you this, the AR-15 is a fairly, you can't even deer hunt legally with an AR-15. I don't know if people know that. There are much more powerful rifles probably in most people's gun case right next to an AR-15. And so, again, I think we have to get to the efficacy of this. What are we trying to solve? And is it the AR-15 or is it the person using the AR-15? Is it the reporting system? In Florida in particular, I don't know. I don't understand why there isn't more of a conversation of why, where people have seen something and said something, and we as government officials have encouraged them to do that. They saw something, they said something, but the authorities that were supposed to be in jurisdiction of that didn't do either anything or obviously enough. What is the point of making us feel like we're safe by seeing something, saying something, if nobody's going to do anything? And I think that ought to be a part of the equation too. The AR-15 is a tool, just like a .30-06, just like a handgun. Some people might prefer the AR-15 for their personal protection. Some people might prefer a shotgun. Some people might prefer a handgun. And so when you say, what is the legitimate use? I mean, somebody could say, well, look, you have no legitimate use for any of those things. We have to deal with the reality that we live in and the Constitution, where we all raise our right hand and take an oath upon to uphold and defend, which is that there is a Second Amendment in the Constitution which gives the rights of Americans to hold and bear arms. Right, and that's the reality of the situation. So, in that context, how do we keep ourselves safe, and how do we keep these very destructive weapons potentially out of the hands of people that shouldn't have them?
And so, to that Second Amendment argument about, you know, the Constitution saying that, I believe the exact wording is, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right to bear arms shall not be infringed. Your position is that there are no arms that can be banned?
Certainly not.
Where do you draw that line?
I have constituents that want a Nike missile. I have a constituent that thinks he should have a tank, an anti-tank weapon. Literally, I have these constituents that come to me and say, who are you to tell us we can't have those things? I think there are limits, but we have to, the bump stock is an interesting conversation. I know you haven't asked about it, but when we talk about banning the bump stock, people say, well, how do you define it? It doesn't make the weapon automatic. It's not an automatic weapon. It allows you to pull the trigger faster. Mm-hmm. Well, what if you can just pull the trigger fast because your finger can go that fast? Maybe it can pull as fast as somebody else with a bump stock. You can do it without one. These are the conversations that we get into, and I think that they are appropriate. So that our founders set this government up to make sure that we didn't make knee-jerk reactions that didn't require complete thought and understand the ramifications and the consequences of our actions in limiting people's freedoms.
Mm-hmm. And so then the last question I would have about the gun issue, and I don't know if you saw this, there was a piece in, I believe, in National Review a day or two ago written by, I want to say it was David French, who kind of floated this idea of a gun violence restraining order, in which essentially if a close family member and there were a few criteria, and I forget what they all were, but essentially if someone knows that, you know, someone that they live with or are close with or are family members with should not have a weapon, they can go to court and get a restraining order to stop them from having a gun, similarly to, I guess, protection from abuse or something like that. Is that kind of, you know, in the ballpark of things that you would consider?
I think it should be. There again, if you see something and you want to say something, that portends somebody's going to do something. And so I think that, again, we would have to look at what the parameters are. And there are times when people, unfortunately, would use a law like that to disenfranchise somebody. Let's just say a lady who's angry with her husband, and he's a hunter, and she knows how to push his buttons, and she's mad at him for whatever infraction he's imposed upon their marriage, and she says, "Well, I'm going to submit this because I don't think he should be able to have his firearms." And so there has to be a due process there, but I think that that's a reasonable thing that we should discuss that has some legitimacy.
Shifting now to the tragic mass shooting at the Mandalay Bay Hotel in Las Vegas last October. You appeared on Tucker Carlson Tonight on Fox News last month and said you've been made aware of credible evidence that foreign terrorists were connected to the attack. Here's what you had to say on the show.
Well, I smell a rat like a lot of Americans do. Nothing's adding up. It's been 4 months, as you said. The man's dead. They said he's a lone gunman, lone shooter, yet we can't get the autopsy results. But even more troubling than that, recently I've been made aware of what I believe to be credible evidence or credible information regarding potential terrorist infiltration through the southern border regarding this incident.
So at the time, you didn't have any evidence to share with the public to substantiate your claims, but you did say that information would be released in the coming days. Now, over a month since that interview, we still haven't seen any of that evidence. Do you have any idea when this will become available to the general public?
So I'm not the recipient of the evidence. I just want to tell you this. I received a briefing on that attack in the secret compartmentalized information facility, which we generally call a SCIF, right? Mm-hmm. Where you have to have a secret clearance to get in there. I received a briefing on that attack, and the information I received in that briefing differs from the information that you're seeing in open source news.
Okay.
I don't have the it's not in my care, so I can't release it, but I'm hopeful that you will get the same information that I have received.
So this information obviously would have come from an intelligence agency then. Can you share a little bit about this?
I got the information from an intelligence analyst.
Okay.
And then I know we're running out of time. I do want to get your take on another issue in Pennsylvania specifically, which is the redistricting and the recent developments that have happened. Just so everyone's aware, we're recording this on Tuesday. Yesterday, Monday, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court released a new map for congressional districts after a few weeks ago, I believe it was, invalidating the current map for being unconstitutional under the state constitution. And so I think it's important for people to realize that a lot of these cases have been going to the United States Supreme Court or being challenged in federal court. This was at the state level that this happened. So first, this map, I believe, was approved in 2011 when you were a member of the state house, the original map.
Map that where the districts were currently serving.
The map in which you represent the 4th district.
Correct.
Of Pennsylvania
yes.
was.
Yes.
And so can you talk a little bit about the process of how you got to that map and whether you, I mean, I'm assuming if you voted for it, you believe it did not violate the state constitution.
I don't think it did, because the state constitution essentially says the legislature will draw or define the districts, and that's generally where it ends. I didn't draw the map. There were legislative leaders, quite honestly, put the map together with experts that can work out populations and so on and so forth to make sure that it comports with all the requirements of maybe compactness and contiguousness and so on and so forth. And so they show us a series of maps, and you get a choice to vote yes or no, and they reach a consensus, again, a kind of an agreement or a deal. And so I didn't have anything to do with putting together the maps. The legislators didn't come to me and say, hey, I'd like this in my district. I don't want that in my district. I never had any of those conversations. Literally, what I got was an up or down vote on the congressional map, and they put it in front of me, and I said, well, as long as it meets the criteria, that's fine with me. And so, yeah, so I voted on the map, and then lo and behold, months later, I'm running for an office in the seat that I hope to represent, and I'm thinking to myself, who put this map together, right? So, but that's how it happened, at least then. But at least the legislature agreed to it, right? Democrats and Republicans, House and Senate, came to an agreement and sent it to the governor for a signature, and that's how the current map, and oh, by the way, approved by the Supreme Court, that map 6 years ago, approved by the Supreme Court, that's the map the districts are currently serving in. A suit was brought. As you might know or might not know, this was a project by President Obama and Eric Holder once they left office to redistrict the states individually. And so they found they came up with a thing called the Efficiency Clause, and they worked through a plaintiff to say that these maps are not correct, and brought a lawsuit, to which the Supreme Court agreed with them that they were not correct. And then, of course, they gave the legislature a period of time to redraw the maps. In my opinion, it's a fairly small amount of time. The legislature did submit a new map or new maps. It's my understanding that either the court or somebody didn't approve of those maps, and so we have a new map, and I'm not sure who came up with that map. But I know I got to be careful of my words here because I wasn't in the room, but I'm fairly certain the Pennsylvania legislature did not come up with this map currently in front of me.
Mm-hmm. So just some further context on that. When the court initially issued its ruling, there was that very tight timeline that you mentioned, in which the legislature was supposed to approve a map, send it to the governor, and the governor was to, you know, they were to come to an agreement, and that right. was to be submitted to the court. I believe Speaker Terzai, the Pennsylvania Speaker of the House, and Senator Scarnati, the Senate majority, or I guess the Senate pro tempore, came to the map that was sent to Governor Wolf. It was not voted upon, and I think they cited some time constraints. But so ultimately, I believe 7 maps were submitted to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, some by the Democratic leaders in the Senate who say they were left out of the process, and the House Democrats and the governor, and I think the parties to the case were also welcome to submit maps. None of those, I believe, most of those maps were made public. None of them are the map that came out today. So looking at the 4th District, currently, it now appears, at least to my reading, that it will be separated into 3 different districts. In Southern York County, which is currently part of the 4th District, that will be joining up with Lancaster County in the 11th District. Northern York County, which I guess you will live in the new 10th District.
That's correct. That's where I'm currently residing.
And then Adams County, which is where Gettysburg is, of course, has now been joined with Franklin and Fulton counties out to the west in the new 13th District. So, I mean, how do you see this new map? I mean, it sounds like there may be a challenge in federal court, but starting in, you know, I believe in May, there's a primary election that will, you know, be using this new map. How do you kind of approach not knowing what district you're in? Or maybe, you know, are you planning to, you know, run in the 10th district? Or, you know, what district would you consider you're intending to seek re-election?
That's my current plan. I mean, you have to use the most current information you have. And while I know there is going to be a court challenge, I don't know how that's going to turn out. So right now, the authority, so to speak, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court has said, this is the new map. You can start circulating petitions next week. And so while I disagree with the process of this map, and again, legislators like me, we don't have any input into the map. We're not supposed to, and it's inappropriate that we would weigh in. But I think it is appropriate that we follow a constitutional process, because not everybody's going to be happy, no matter who draws the map. That's why you have a process. And it seems to me that there is no provision for the Supreme Court and the Constitution to draw the map, assuming that the legislature can't come to an agreement. You know, you could look at it as Scarnati and Terzai did come to an agreement, right? I mean, and while Democrats didn't, Republicans and Democrats oftentimes disagree, but we work some arrangement out, some deal, I hate to use that term, but where enough votes pass something. The timeline was short, and so I'm concerned about not only people that are seeking office, like myself, trying to put something together and not really understanding, but you got to consider things too, like absentee ballots for service members that are overseas and the timeline to fit within that May timeframe, when they don't even know what the districts are right now or who their potential representatives may be. And if they can't vote within the time frame, and there's a fairly long lead time for them to get their absentee ballot in because it's coming from overseas, then I think that this probably should be revisited. And I will just tell you this, I question the timing of this, jamming it right up against the primary itself. This map approved, not this map, but the previous map approved by that same Supreme Court and seemed to be fine for 6 years. Now, I know there were disagreements about it. There were disagreements about it when it was voted into law 6 years ago. But there's always going to be disagreements. The real issue to me should be, Are we following the process? Each of us, again, raises our right hand and swears to uphold and defend the Constitution. And that's just the difference is whether you have the integrity to follow it or not. And if you can find enough people just to disagree with the rules, then we don't have any rule. And so that's why we have a Constitution. That's why we have a rule, so that we understand this is the standard we follow. And not everybody's going to be happy, but as long as we follow that, that's how we get to the answer. That doesn't seem to be the case in this instance.
But just to be clear, it is currently your intent to run in the future in the 10th district as opposed to one of the other ones that are currently part of the 4th.
That is true. I know that you can run in another district other than the one you reside. I don't think that's something that I would ever really entertain doing. I know that some people have asked me, to run in some other district, but I just don't think that's appropriate. So we'll run in the 10th if it lasts, and if it doesn't, then we'll see what they come up with next.
Indeed. And then the final question for you is about fiscal policy. The week before last, the House and Senate passed the Bipartisan Budget Act of 2018, which ended the second government shutdown of 2018 and funds the government through September 2019. It includes $300 billion in spending increases, lifting caps that were imposed in 2011, and increases spending for both military and for domestic programs. You're an avowed fiscal conservative, a member of the House Freedom Caucus. You voted against the bill. Can you talk about why?
Well, we've been asking, first of all, the appropriation process is broken. The process goes like this. I think for context, I need to describe this. There are 12 appropriations bills. That's how we determine how much we spend on what our priorities are. So there are 12 of these bills. The House is supposed to vote on their 12. The Senate is supposed to vote on their 12. Bring them together, what's called a conference committee, work out the differences, and send that package to the president for a signature. And that's how we fund the government. That's how we decide the priorities and the amount of money that goes to them. That process I just described to you hasn't come together in about 10 years, or probably over 10 years now. So the process is broken, which is why we keep on having these government shutdowns and these continuing resolutions. So backtrack to last September when the fiscal year ended, I told the speaker, let's fund the military to the end of the year, and then we can work out our differences on this domestic spending. And they said, no, we're close to an agreement here. Let's just do a continuing resolution for a few weeks. Well, this was the fifth one. This was the fifth one that I voted against.
The fifth
continuing resolution, where we essentially funded the government month by month by month. And in particular for things like the military, you can't run a military funding it month by month, because they can't start new programs that we've required them to start, but they must pay for programs that they want to shut down and are no longer functional. So it's wildly inefficient, not to mention it just ends up costing the taxpayers more. So we agreed in the House, finally, that we would vote finally about a week and a half before this fifth continuing resolution to fund the military to the end of the fiscal year and hold the line on this domestic spending and try and work that out after the fact. We sent that to the Senate. The Senate rejected it immediately, added 3.85, because you didn't add the disaster spending into that, so $385 billion to the federal deficit, and sent it back to the House. That's not something I think my constituents agree with. This budget puts us somewhere between $1.1 and $1.2 trillion in deficit spending. And if you don't understand what deficit spending is, that is what you spend in excess of what you bring in annually. So $1.1 to $1.2 trillion this year in excess of what we take in revenue. So our country's going broke. We're $20 trillion in debt, and it requires lawmakers to make some tough choices and prioritize what we've got to spend our money on. The military is a constitutional imperative. We got to keep our country safeguarded. And that's not to say that the military doesn't have its own problems and inefficiencies, fraud, waste, or abuse that need to be dealt with. But it's really hard to deal with it when you're funding it a month at a time. And so I was supportive of funding the military and then trying to work out some of these other differences. My other colleagues weren't, and they were willing to spend the additional money. I simply was not. I don't think that we should be put in a position of choosing to fund the military or bankrupt the country. That's a Hobson's choice to me, and I don't want to bankrupt the country. That's just as perilous as not funding your military. And indeed, the top brass in the military has long said that our national debt and deficit is a national security problem. But yet, they just agreed to go ahead and spend all this money that we don't have.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I think we're going to have to leave it there. Congressman Perry, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. Thanks for this opportunity.
That's On Target for this week. We'd like to thank U.S. Congressman Scott Perry for being our featured guest today.
We'd also like to thank the staff of the Gettysburgian and the executive board of WZBT for their support of this project. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, Google Play, wherever else you might get your podcasts. As long as it's one of the places we publish, you can always find it at gettysburgian.com/podcast.
On Target is a joint production of the Gettysburgian and WZBT. Our theme music was composed by Diego Rocha, of the class of 2019, who was a music major focusing on composition from the Sunderman Conservatory of Music.